Mrs. Ada Rowe tells of the coming of the telegraph, telephone, the railroads, and other important concerns in the life of the early settlers of the Peace River District.
60 degrees below, snapping the new wire in many places. This intense cold was followed by strong winds which overturned great numbers of trees, so that linemen had a difficult task to make the necessary repairs. From all points of the north, the government telegraph service was continually in receipt of letters expressing the delight of the people in having telegraphic connection. Businessmen from that territory visiting Edmonton went to the district headquarters of the service to express their great satisfaction at the action of the department in building the line. During the year 1912, the line into Peace River Crossing was extended to Dunvegan, then to Saskatoon Lake. The inrush of settlers had the effect of greatly increasing the cost of maintenance, particularly in the matter of provender for horses. Hay sold as high as $30 a ton, oats $153 per bushel, there being no established prices. An appropriation of funds was made in 1913 for the construction of the telephone line from Girard to High Prairie. The volume of business steadily increased on the Edmonton-Peace River line in 12 and 13. The great bulk of the business was done with Edmonton, it being the commercial center to this country to the north, and it was found necessary to engage another operator to assist the agent at this point. During the year 1913 and 14, the lines, for the most part, were kept in good working order. However, the section between Athabasca and Girard gave much trouble. This section traversed heavily timbered areas and fierce forest fires sweeping through the district burned poles and killed trees, many of which, left standing, later were blown down by strong winds and fell on the wire. During the summer of 1913, extremely heavy rains caused the Lesser Slave Lake to overflow its banks and flood that portion of the line between Sawbridge and Girard. This, with the trouble caused by the ED and BC Railway while clearing their right-of-way, gave linemen a great deal of extra work. In 1914 and 15, Lesser Slave Lake again overflowed its banks and washed out a portion of the line. During the time the line was down, messages were transferred by boat between Sawbridge and Girard. A few miles of line in the most troublesome part were moved to higher ground. An appropriation was available during this year for the extension of the line from Lake Saskatoon to Hudson's Hope. An office was established at Kuskokwim on February the 11th, 1915, and on March the 5th at Fort St. John. The line was completed to Hudson Hope on August 4th, 1915, giving a continuous wire to Edmonton, 748 miles distant. It is interesting to note that of an expenditure of about $87,000, over $5,000, was spent on feed for horses and nearly $500 for smithing. Settlers of the district were prodigal in their thanks to the department for placing them in touch with the outer world. Settlers in great numbers were still pushing onwards, far beyond railways, while the government telegraph line was the one thing that gave them connection with the outside. The importance of this line to the settlers, businessmen, and the country generally cannot be overestimated. The first provincial police officer was stationed in the Kilkerran district. This was Mr. Duncan, and he lived within a quarter mile of the Piper homestead, establishing the police station there in 1914. In 1917, Constable Duncan moved to the present site of Kuskokwim Village. Besides his duties as police constable, he was register of births, deaths, and marriages, official administrator, mining recorder, game warden, etc. The first settlers had a very long journey to make to file their land claims. They had to go to Grand Prairie, to the Dominion Land Office there. Pictures show a small office on a muddy street and a long, patient queue of men waiting to file. Stories tell that men stood in the queue all night rather than lose their places in the line. In 1915, George Solway, a homesteader who lived close to Pooscoopy, was appointed land's agent, and in 1918 this office was turned over to Tom Jameson, who served the settlers for a number of years from a small building on his Pooscoopy farm. He served as sub-agent for the Dominion Lands Department until 1930. Other government agencies followed the police and lands department, settling officers and homes in Pooscoopy. In winter of 1920 and 21, a government agency was established under a Mr. Moore, followed shortly by Mr. Fred Fraser. Magistrate Aubrey Fisher was named deputy agent, and Mr. Lester Harper was named head of the taxation office. At first, court cases were few, and usually settled before the magistrate. Cases beyond the magistrate's jurisdiction were heard at Fort George, as Prince George was then called, This procedure was expensive, so next a judge was sent in once a year from Fort George. Judge Robinson, the first of these, enjoyed a bush holiday. He made his annual trips in by way of boat down the old trade route of the Parsnip and Peace Rivers. Having arrived at Taylor Flats, the judicial parcel traveled overland to Pooscoopy, and there settled whatever cases were slated for trial. Duties accomplished, Judge Robertson journeyed on to Edmonton, thence to Fort George. In 1916, Bank of Commerce opened a branch under William Hassard in a corner of Frank Haskins' store in Coos. 6 months later, the bank moved into the building the Pooscoopy branch of the Canadian Bank of Commerce still occupies. And in 1919, two banks, the Merchants Bank and the Bank of Commerce, opened branches in Rolla. Although these bank openings foretold the present busy commercial life of the district, it seems unlikely that large sums of money were then being deposited or loaned, because the settlers were so very largely occupied getting their first small field into production. Most wheat beyond the homesteaders' own seed requirements would be sold to some later arrival, as would oats or bundles. It took the work of some years and a deal of money to change a homestead into a paying farm. Meanwhile, homesteaders often ran a winter trap line to get ready cash. Earliest crops were flailed out. The first threshing machine was owned by Hector Tremblay. It was turned by horse teams. And about this machine, Bud Piper tells, "The first time we thrashed grain, 4 stacks of oats, a cog wheel broke, and repairs to allow finishing of the stock thrashing were not obtained until the next spring. The settlers were dependent on their vegetable gardens. One early flower garden was grown by Mrs. Esme Tuck of Pooscoopy in 1920. Old-timers invariably recall with pleasure the fun they enjoyed in those early days, so a reader shouldn't get the idea that life was all work. Everyone who possibly could attend the social gatherings, if attendance implied bringing the family cow as well as the family, well, that was accepted and done. The first hall in the country was at Pooscoopy North, or Rolla. This hall was a fine log building. It was opened in July 1915 with a 2 days sports. There was dancing on the two nights in a fiddler's orchestra from Grand Prairie. The first sports of the district had been held in July 1914 at Tremblay's. The dance following was held on the floor of their large, new, unfinished house. At the same place on July 1st, 1915, the first community picnic was held. People enjoyed a tug-of-war, log rolling on the river, and a dance that lasted for 2 nights. Kilcarron and Rolla boasted their baseball teams. An old-timer reports the first stampede held at Rolla in 1919 and the first fair in Dawson Creek about 1922 and the first large agricultural fair at Rolla in 1923. Fortunately, these pioneer people were mostly young and healthy. There was no resident doctor. In emergencies, good neighbors such as Mrs. Kate Edwards, Mrs. Mixer, Mrs. Bullen, Mrs. Miller, and Mrs. Vincent were skilled, kindly nurses. Of this group, only Mrs. Mixer was a registered nurse. Mrs. Mixer describes a trying season in 1919. Then came the time of the flu epidemic. It was pretty bad to try to get along without a doctor. I went to Poos for 3 weeks. Meanwhile, a neighbor took my place at home. A Mr. Brown in a little restaurant in Pooscoopy had 7 people in bed and was trying to cope with the situation. Finally, the bank manager in Poos got busy on the wires, and a doctor came one very dark night. No moon, no stars, and we all kept looking down the road for that little beam of light. However, soon after that, Dr. Archie Watson came and took up residence in Pooscoopy. There was some beginning of public health services also. One account tells, the first doctor visited schools in 1919. He rode a horse for these visits and for vaccinating children. There was no hospital until 1921. And on October 17th of that year, the Alberta Red Cross opened a hospital in Pooscoopy. In emergencies, the settlers still had a long, wearying trip by team to get to Poos, but once there, had competent medical care. Also, records tell of Dr. Watson. No trip was too hard, no trail too bad, no winter's day too cold, and no distance too far for him to answer a call of distress. Meanwhile, the ED and BC Railway was extended gradually closer and closer to the BC Peace River District, and in 1914 the rails reached Mirror Landing. McLennan was picked to be divisional point. By 1916, the north branch of the line reached Peace River Town, and the southern reached Spirit River. From Spirit River, the contractors built the grade 30 miles further until it neared the Pooscoopy Prairie. However, the steel was not laid on this grade. Instead, the railroad was completed to Grand Prairie, where the farms were longer established and well-developed, but lacked a market. This was in the middle of the First World War years, and no more steel was to be had for railroad construction. However, the BC settlers made good use of the railway grade. It was the shortest, best route to a railhead and became the freighting road so well known as the Spirit River Trail. On occasions when the road from Grand Prairie was passable, the first motor car of the Grand Prairie District made taxi trips in. The first motor car, privately owned and operated in our area, was driven in from Grand Prairie to Rolla in 1919 by Charlie Hatch, son of James Hatch, pioneer of the Rolla district. The census of 1911 showed a total population of less than 2,000 persons in the entire Peace River district. Included in this figure were settlers, traders, missionaries, and Indians. The census of 1921 showed 20,000. The Pooscoopy Prairie in this decade had registered one of the largest rates of population growth because before 1912 not many more than a dozen people comprised the population. After the first rush of homesteaders, the population figure remained stable for some years. A large proportion of the younger men joined up and went off to do their part in World War I. The survivors returned after spreading the good news of their fertile farm land. In the Reconstruction period following the war, many returned veterans came to settle in the area which their builders had described so glowingly. One group numbering 23 returned soldiers and their families settled in the Sunset Prairie area in the summer of 1919. Fortunes fluctuated with the times. And when individual fortunes went from bad to worse, some of these first homesteaders left to try their luck elsewhere. Several circumstances made settlers proud of their new country. One was the readiness of the neighbors to pitch in and help wherever needed. Another was the honesty of the settlers. Old-timers invariably recall that house doors were never locked.
Erickman Hendricks interviewing Sid Chilton, one of the first residents in Dawson Creek. He's going to tell us about some of his experiences as he came along. Mr. Chilton.
Well, I arrived in Dawson Creek about the 1st of December of 1930. And there was no buildings on the town site, to my recollection, in those days. Because I had to go over to the old town for my meals. But about a week or 10 days after that, a Chinaman built a little bit of a building on Main Street and opened a restaurant. And to my recollection, that was the first building to be built in Dawson Creek.
And what did you find in Dawson Creek at that time?
Well, there were no buildings of anything in Dawson Creek at that time. The Keller Farm was there. The buildings was on the side of the creek down there. And they were the people that sold the farm to the town soldiers. And then it built up quite quick. Harper's moved their store over from the old town. And I think there was a contractor that was on the railroad by the name of Wynn. I think he hauled the Harper's store over with the tractors. But the Co-op store was brought over by Mr. McQueen, and that was brought across there with a windlass. Horsepower on a windlass.
Yeah. How about a hotel?
Well, the hotel was brought over too. And I believe that came as a way of the windows too. And of course, the hotel wasn't very big at that time. I mean, they built an addition onto that, you see. So it wasn't such a large building for the move, but the Co-op was quite a store for the move. It took several. Well, I guess it would take maybe 10 days bringing that over. This was pretty slow with a horsepower. Windows. So then I bought rain here then until about 1942. And that was the time that the Alaska Highway started, and so I quit buying grain, and I had some trucks on the highway. And then I bought the farm where the Chilton subdivision is, and I put in a subdivision in there in the later 50s. And I left in 1961 for Abbotsford, British Columbia, and that's where I'm living to the present day.
Well, in this Chilton subdivision, what did you have to do in order to be able to sell the lots?
We had to survey it. We had to have it surveyed, and it was all surveyed out in half acre lots and acre lots.
And did it sell very quite fast, or?
Oh, yes, it sold.
Any specifications as to the homes that are supposed to be built on them, or?
No.
Anything?
There's no regulation in those things, anything like that.
Yeah. What kind of grain did, what elevator did you work in, and what grain did you buy?
as the United Grain Growers that I worked in. And it was wheat and oats and barley. We didn't have them other seeds in those days, the rape seed or such as that. And this was never much of a flax country anyway, so there was never much flax raised here. I did handle a little flax, but it wasn't very much.
Well, after you left the elevator, what other business did you engage in?
Well, I worked for Ace Comstock in his real estate office for a while. Then afterwards, I worked with W.C. Bold in real estate.
Yeah. But how many years were you on that?
I guess we say, we was there a couple of years, I guess, wasn't it, Bob? Yeah, I was at Comstock. And then that was before I put in the subdivision.
Oh, yeah.
After I put in the subdivision, when I finished selling all my lots there, I sold my farm to the rest of the land to Patrick, ain't that his name? Well, that's when I left.
Patrick or Patrick?
Patrick.
Patrick?
I think they're in the place yet.
Yeah. Can you tell us anything else about what you thought, saw and Dr. Creek at that time? When did they really jump?
Well, the biggest jump was when the Alaska Highway came, you see. And then also they landed the American soldiers in there. And they came in the middle of the night. First train of soldiers came in here in the middle of the night, and the next morning, like, the town was just flooded with soldiers, you see.
And where did they get started?
Yeah. See, that was getting ready for the Alaska Highway.
Oh, yeah.
So it was quite a place around here where the, when that Alaska Highway was on. It was coming and going, lots of them. Quite a busy town.
And you took up trucking about that same time, did you?
Yes, I had trucks on the highway.
And what did you haul?
Always hauling oil and hauling everything else, you know. Freight.
How far?
Well, we hauled as far as Whitehorse. I think I had a truck on the first convoy that went all the way through to Whitehorse. You see, it went through in convoys, and I had one truck on that convoy, the Spinney.
Yeah.
The Spinney had the contract.
Oh, yeah, the Spinney. What were the roads like?
Well, it wasn't a bad road. It was, there was holes in it and such as that, but as a whole, the road wasn't too bad. If the weather was good, of course, when the weather got muddy or something like that, well, it was pretty muddy.
How were you fixed the stopping places on the road?
Well, there was quite a few stopping places because, you see, the construction camps were so on there. You could always stop at them.
So that was great help then, when
yes.
You came to the construction camp, you could camp there. How long have you been away now?
16 years.
What's your impression of you came back?
Well, I see a big change.
In what way?
In the town, for one reason, and also the farming. There's a lot of good land been under cultivation since my days around.
So you think it's grown considerably since you were?
Oh, yes, it has.
Anything else you'd like to say about Dr. Creek while you're at it?
Well, I don't know. I might say that I think it's the greatest country that's ever laid outdoors. I really like this Peace River country, and I've wished many a times that I never moved away from it. But as far as coming back now, I think I'm too old to come back. Because I'm getting up in years pretty well. So, I've often thought about moving back with you just the same.
Yeah. Well, that's what I've always found. I always found it a nice place to live. I've been since 1930, and I've never regretted it.
And I've got a lot of good friends here that I'd like to get back and visit with.
Sure.
The Seeker family has been very good to me in my life. And I think an awful lot of them.
Okay, well, we've got to go back.
All I can say is that I've seen quite a few of the old timers since I've been back here. I'm very glad to be back and see them once again anyway.
So, sure. Okay, well, thank you very much, Mr. Chilton.
Mr. Chilton has a little incident he'd like to relate in connection with the fire which happened about that time. 1943, was it?
I believe it was, yes.
1943. Mr. Chilton again.
Well, I owned the Bentley Barn, and that's where I had it rented out to this construction outfit, or to the Army, rather. And they unloaded dynamite in there, and caps. And the building caught fire, and of course those caps and dynamite all exploded. And it pretty well cleaned up that whole block, even down to the Co-op store. I heard there was dynamite in it. I was standing out on the corner there by the Ridgeback Hotel, and when I heard there was dynamite in there, I made tracks for up at the elevator for to get away from it. But I got caught right up at the corner of the livery barn up there, and if I hadn't have been in close to the building, I think I would have got hit with a big piece of timber because it would come down over the roof, and when I hit the roof, well, it slid out and missed me. If I'd have been out a little bit further, why, it would have got me. But there was lots of things flying around in the air there, so that I think there was the anvil in the blacksmith shop. They picked that up way up near where the dam is now. So it was quite an exciting time around here that night of that, because no place to eat, and a lot of windows were broken in the stores and restaurants. So it was quite a mix-up. So I guess that's about all I can say. I did go down and help Hans Ludvigsen. He was running the bake shop. And we went down and we made donuts all night for him anyway. And then something to eat. It wasn't much, but it was better than anything at all because there's no place else to eat.